Accession number 28355, reel 9.
Yes, really, looking at this, the difficulty is, where do you draw the line on sort of things to talk about? Without sort of going back, if I went back through, I think I probably got my programs from being CDS. I could say, well, I was in Belize with then and I met somebody, but I was looking through some photograph albums the other day. Somebody who is, believe it or not, collects as a hobby RAF uniforms and insignia, had written to me, and did I have some particular epaulette, which yes I have, but I used them, so he's not getting them. But I felt, he'd written to me once before. I felt, and I have got a, are we recording? It doesn't matter.
Yes, yes,
it doesn't matter. Yes. But I have got a white uniform, an RAF white uniform, which I wore.
I didn't know they had them.
No, well, you may well say. But out in Singapore, for some bizarre reason, we continue to wear white uniforms. And I had to go as CDS on an official visit to Singapore, and I was going to take salutes and watch marching out parades or graduation parades and so on. So I had a white uniform made for me, and I wore it then. I suppose I wore it once or twice otherwise, but it's absolutely brand new, and it's been sitting in the cupboard ever since. And that was 15 years ago, so it really was taking up, I won't say valuable space, but taking up unnecessary space. So I told this chap, would he like it? Yes, please. So then I thought, I suppose I better look out a photograph of me wearing the thing. And I've got, I don't know what one does with all this stuff, but I've got a 3x2x2 packing case stuffed with official photograph albums of yours truly and my wife going to various places, ranging from the United States, the Soviet Union, China to Nigeria, Australia to Timbuktu. And eventually, after I've been through this, about all these, because they're not catalogued or anything, I found the Singaporeans, and I found a photograph with myself, so I was able to give it to them. Why did I mention this? Because one did do, both as CS and as CDS, a lot of exchange visits. You had both incomers and outgoers, quite often far enough inspired ones. They weren't your choice. You obviously were happy to do them in that sense. But very often they are defense sales inspired, or foreign office good relations inspired, or returns for ones where they'd asked you and you were asking them back. One got around the world, quite a lot, both as CAS and as CDS on these. And I think, to the extent that later on you bump into these people or you can recall having met somebody that knows them, it has a value. It's very hard, I think, to measure. I don't know if anybody's ever run a rule over and what the cost-benefit analysis of doing these things are, but we do them, we continue to do them, and I think it's one of those sort of intangibles. You can't really put down the price of me meeting you and getting to know each other for a few days, then being totally unable to recall your name or your face in 10 years' time, even when I see it in an album. But I think that's also being 75 years old and not necessarily. I think there's less grey matter to stuff things into as you get older. Bits fall out. Or die off. Where were we? You had a question. And what that started that off?
The question that started it off was, some of the sketches of your colleagues, which...
I think we've dealt with.
Which you've kindly given
yeah,
me.
Yeah, and that led on to a rather broader... expression of view about how the chiefs of staff should or should not work.
Yes, yes. And I'm just going to ask this question. George Younger asks you to go into his office at the MOD and says, would you like to be CDS?
Yeah.
Did you have, well, there are two questions. One, did you have any inkling that it might be you? I suspect the answer might be not, because...
We'd had Wynne Bramall, we'd had John Fieldhouse.
So it might be an airman.
So it could be an airman. So to that extent, yes, that might be in the frame. But I do remember, because John Fieldhouse, I think quite rightly, didn't like others going to see the Secretary of State, unless he knew he was going to see the Secretary of State. And I got this, someone's going to see the Secretary of State. So I popped into John Fieldhouse's office next door, and I said, I'm going to see the Secretary of State. I don't know if it's about you, Cadgy, or something like that. He said, well, you better go and find out. So, I mean, he knew what it was about, but I was, you know, thinking back, it was interesting that I'd been into John Fieldhouse, thinking I was going to see Secretary of State about some Air Force business. It wasn't what I'd expected on that occasion. But you know, that's the way these things go. You know.
Yes. Well, that really answered the two points I was going to raise. I know that when you become CDS, of course, all your chiefs change again.
Yeah, fairly soon afterward. John Chappell came in place of Nigel, and William Staveley went, and Julian came in, and Peter Harding, of course, took over my slot.
Took over your slot.
Yes.
Okay. I don't know whether, if you've got anything further you'd like to add at this stage before we move on to CDS, this might then be a point to pause.
Yeah. You may remember that John Fieldhouse had an aneurysm, I think it is, when he was on a NATO visit in Brussels about 2 or 3 weeks before he retired. He was due to retire. So that was a bit of a shock, not only to him, and he never fully recovered, poor chap. But I was also going to have a gallbladder operation in the interregnum, so we looked a bit thin on the ground for a short while. But I recovered from that. This was, I think, my last day as CAS was on the Cenotaph Parade. And then I think the next day I went down to Halton and they dealt with my gallbladder.
In November.
Of 88.
November 88.
Yeah, November, December. So looking at the photographs of me, I'm taking post in January. I suppose in December I took over, 9th of December. So it was only quite soon after that, a month after the gallbladder operation. I look a bit thin and wan. At least my wife thinks I do, anyway. I've got, as far as CDS is concerned, I've got a few notes about the Gulf War, which I think might be worth reading into the record.
Yes.
I remember thinking that, if Alan Brooke could do it, it was a rather grand idea that this was World War III or something, but it wasn't. But, we hadn't really done big operations then like we've been doing ever since. That was the first one up, so I thought I ought to do it, but I'm not. I'm not a diarist. And, I don't know how Alan Brooke ever did get down at 1 and 2 in the morning to writing the copious and detailed diary that he did. The best I managed was a few lines. Most nights, I think I was looking through it a little while ago, and not so long ago, there was one day where it says, can't remember a thing. Always that effect.
David, thank you. We'll end on this note then, with just this point, and that is that we've moved over CAS reasonably swiftly. Would that be because you inherited another very efficient, well-working, well-oiled machine in the way that you inherited a very fine machine?
Yes, I mean, there were various big issues then, you see. For example, one of them was the, I think it was called, in those days, the Future Management Strategy, FMS. And this, up till that time, the only people who had real power over money were the civil servants, even as a commander-in-chief at High Wycombe. I had power to write off up to, I think, a maximum of 50 grand, a bit more money than it is now, but it's still not an awful lot of money when you think of the size of the budgets. And even then, I could only authorize it with the approval of the command secretary. So the responsibility for operations and for personnel and everything was not combined with financial authority. And that always bugged me. And during this time in ICS, we started down what was a long and torturous and difficult route, because the civil servants were not about to give up, to set up budgets for commanders in chief and board members. And there again, I think it's an area of interest if somebody wants to, you know, focus on one particular aspect of how financial authority moved and is probably continuing to move, and the difficulties which the military found in relation to their civilian colleagues who had, anyway, in one sense, POS is the accounting officer. He is responsible to Parliament for the defence budget. And he can only be overruled if a minister says, even though you tell me I shouldn't spend it, I will spend it. And then it's on the minister's head. But otherwise, ultimately it's PUS. And you know, if you've got responsibility for several billions in that sense, you want to have the control running down through your hierarchical structure. But it doesn't lie happily with the feeling I had that the military, if they don't have financial authority, don't have the full overall command and responsibility that is thrust upon them. And so the future management strategy, I think it was FMS, was designed to try and do something about this. And you know, Ken MacDonald, who was second POS, was very resistant. Eventually we got, in my time there, we got the toe in the door. But now there are top-level budget holders and in uniform, and there is a scheme where the uniform does have financial authority in a way which they never had all through my career, and that I'm sure is a step in the right direction. Now you'll have to ask more recent generations whether it's working well or whether it's a nonsense. But I think it's infinitely better than what was pertained when I was throughout my service career. And it was interesting that that was one of the sort of major features which we were arguing about throughout my time as CAS. And to a less extent as CDS. I can't remember exactly how it sort of moved. I'm sure when I left we were still talking about getting FMS into place. So, you know, it was a long, drawn-out period.
A bit like buying a fighter.
Well, anything in MOT is it's a bloody great tanker. It takes an awful lot of helm to get it to move over. Yeah. Right, okay then.
Don't worry about that. Yeah. I'm an hour fast.
Yeah.
Yes, well, shall we...
We'll meet next Monday and we'll do the golf.
And we'll do the golf.
And if I've thought of anything else which I think would be sensible to put on your tape, I'll help
you. Thank you. And then a bit of post
And then we got to do post-military career. Well, yes. I'm not quite sure what you mean by that. How I've been wasting my time ever since.
Yes, not quite that. Looking after the nation's interest in the upper house, possibly.
Yes.
Trying to, from the depredations of the present administration. Right, we will end there.
Okay.
Lord Craig, thank you very much for continuing with your contribution to the Imperial War Museum Sound Archive. I think we left it last time that it was the 9th of December 88 and you were just taking over your appointment as CDS. But I think what you'd like to do this afternoon is jump ahead to your tenure in the post whilst you were directing operations in Gulf War I, and then we might go back. Back to December 88, if you wish. But we're going to go straight now, I think, to Gulf War I, or it's or the prelude, which, however you like to play it.
Yeah, that's fine. The reason for this is my something is I've got some notes handy on this, and before I sort of lose them again, I thought we'd better have a look at them. To remind your listener, the Iraq was invaded. Iraq invaded Kuwait in the night of the 1st, 2nd of August, and nobody expected them to do it. On the 2nd of August, I was actually taking the Sovereign's Parade at Cranmore, and on the 3rd of August, as programmed, I was off to Park House, that's our home in Norfolk, on leave. But that didn't last very long. By the 6th of August, I had returned to London, and the 2nd of August, we had a Chiefs of Staff meeting to consider the military options which we might want the government to consider. And it was clearly agreed round the table we would go for air and speed of reaction, that there were limits on how much could be supported because of the air transport lift. But the aim was to, would be to stop the situation getting worse before trying to affect the freedom of Kuwait. And so my own approach was a deterrent phase with very much the United States in the lead, a speed of reaction which I've just mentioned, a defensive posture to get to Saudi Arabia with Tornado F3s with Grand Rapier, to provide local air defence, to have some offensive capability a bit nearer than based in UK or Germany, and to forward operate base either in Oman, Cyprus or Bahrain, and to have some supportive elements like maritime patrol aircraft and SEAB, and of course HMS York, which was in Bahrain, I think, at the time. So that was the start, as it were. We want to get something up there. So far as the getting people a bit nearer to theatre, the possibilities were putting some troops and more troops into Cyprus, more weapons and weapons into Cyprus, possibly getting the carrier and supporting ships into the Mediterranean, and there were queries about other things like minesweepers, SIGINT capability and so on. So that really was the sort of very beginning, you know, what should we be doing? So those are the sorts of things we were thinking of. Command and control, we had exercise in the past, the sort of Purple Victory, I think they were called, format, which really was based on a 4-star back in UK with a 2-star in theatre. And that, bearing in mind the air element and the initial reaction, pointed very much to High Wycombe being the 4-star commander for this particular operation. Whereas, if you may remember, in the Falklands, it had been very much a Navy-led thing, and so John Fieldhouse had. So there was a pattern which we were adopting. And at this stage, we hadn't taken our thinking further into what is now the position with the Joint Force Headquarters. But the pattern in those days was to pick one of the 4-star headquarters and to beef it up with elements from the other two services to provide a joint force headquarters in all but name. Well, and indeed in name eventually. So that was the start of it.
May I just ask, was it High Wycombe that was likely to be chosen in the way that Northwood was for the Falklands, because this looked like being an Air Force-led dominated operation in terms of either in terms of the airlift or generally?
The position was the Iraqis were in Kuwait. They could have gone a lot further. We were out to stop them doing that as quickly as we could show how. And clearly the Americans were going to do this in spades, but we wanted to be participating. And there was going to be air. There was no question of getting troops out there, and even ships take time. So the air element was going to be the initial reaction. And that pointed, one didn't know whether you were going to go on to the army or the navy thing. You know, the whole thing, this was sort of day three or four after the Iraqis moved into Kuwait. It was very early, and of course, you know, things can change. As we found, they did change, but that was why we started out in the way that we did. Having, as it were, got ourselves up to speed in that way, then there would be some form of follow-through phase if required. Would we be looking for blockading? Would we be looking for more forces in theatre? And what about the sustainability of the forces that we did deploy? So these were the what I call the follow-through phases at that stage that one started to think about. We had worries too, of course. Libya was anything but friendly in those days, and they're not very far from Cyprus. Cyprus was going to be clearly a key base, both in terms of air transport and in terms of possibly bringing forces forward. So, we had to consider the air defence of Cyprus against what Libya might or might not be capable of doing. The CW threat from Iraq was another worry in those days. One believed, and believed rightly, that the Iraqis had got chemical and biological warfare agents. They hadn't obviously deployed them at that stage, but they'd certainly deployed them against their own people in that.
And the Iranians.
And the Iranians. So there was concern that we might find ourselves, even though we were in defensive posture, exposed to this type of attack. And we therefore didn't want to have everything based in one area. We wanted to spread it out a bit. We wanted MBC kit. And because it was hot out there, we were concerned about acclimatization. These are the sorts of issues that have come up. I won't go into them in detail, but just sort of mention them. So that was happening on the 6th, 7th of August. On the 8th of August, ODG, which is really the War Cabinet, of which I was a member, met.
Were you the sole military member?
Yes. Other members, Prime Minister, Foreign Secretary, Defence Secretary, Attorney General. Don't think we. No, I'm sure we didn't have the Chancellor. Somebody else. Anyway, you'll have to look it up.
Well, the Chancellor would have stopped you spending any money.
I think the. No, I'll leave that. And the ODG view is the government will contribute forces to a multinational effort for collective defence of Saudi Arabia and other threatened states in response to any request in support of a United Nations embargo. And we are in touch with allies and friends on the contribution we can make. So that was the line which ODG was following, fairly straightforward. And the next day, the ODG agreed that we'd send one squadron of Tornado F3s as the air defence to Saudi Arabia, and a squadron of Jaguars to Oman. That was offensive capability to get them in theatre, to get them acclimatised and able to do off training in a desert-like environment. Normally based in Kildashaw, wasn't quite the same thing.
May I just ask, when you send a squadron of Tornadoes into the desert, that's 12 or 15 or so many aircraft.
Yeah.
Who actually, and of course the same number of pilots or a few more, but what is the ground support capability that goes with them?
Well, when one talks about sending a squadron, one's sending a composite, obviously the airframes, weapons, the air crew, the ground crew, and some supporting elements and communication, things like that.
So would 1,000 men go?
No, nothing like that. 200 or 300 probably.
Right.
It's that sort of order rather than... It depends on the type of squadron, the operational weapons they use and so on. Funnily enough, it says here, the PM's insistence, three mine countermeasures, the vessels, in other words, minesweepers, to go to the East Mediterranean, but no to the carrier. I hadn't suggested, and it was seen merely as a sort of political move, and certainly Tom King at that time wasn't keen to get overextended, it says here. But the PM was very anxious that we should get something in theatre by the weekend, which, you know, is what we were planning to do.
How quickly would they have been operational if you're going to get them there by the weekend?
Oh, that afternoon.
Okay.
Yes. I mean, when you say operational, you could land, either rearm or arm, rather, and refuel. And providing there was some form of command and control, obviously they didn't just go shooting off, but assuming there's an environment, command control environment, into which they can be plugged, then they're able to operate pretty rapidly. Providing, of course, that the transport force, which has brought out the advance party and all the rest, would also get there. You certainly expect them to be showing some operational capability very shortly after arrival and build up to as full of one as they are capable of within a matter of hours rather than days or weeks. At this time, the French were very keen to talk to me. Maurice Schmidt, who was my French officer number, was trying to get a hold of me. And we did eventually meet, as I'll recount in a moment. I mentioned a moment ago the thoughts about blockading, and we had worries about the legality of that. Certainly the United States were worried about the legality of stopping ships in the high seas. But I think we got round that, if I remember right, with the United Nations help. But the PM, meanwhile, of course, was very keen to see a blockade set up soon. The next day I did meet General Schmidt, and he was really wanting to tell me that they were sending Clemenceau, that was their carrier, with helicopters out to the Red Sea. And they would be relying on in-place forces in Djibouti and a couple of ships and some advisors. So they were, as you can see, keen to be seen to be participating, but very much from the background rather than getting out there into what you might call a war fighting or a war posture. And on that day, the four-star joint force commander, who was Air Marshal Hein, was appointed, and I gave him his directive. We didn't... 10th of August was a Friday, and it says here we didn't make any moves into the Gulf, as it was a Friday, and that's because being the Arab culture, shows just how these sort of different things have to be taken into account.
Yes.
The 11th to 13th, I was actually in Norfolk, and it says here the deployment was going well. 14th of August, we had trouble with the rules of engagement. The UK differed from the US and the Saudi rules of engagement. For example, the number of miles a hostile would travel into Saudi Arabian airspace, or an aircraft, Iraqi aircraft, travel into Saudi Arabian airspace before it was deemed to be hostile. The American case was, and the Saudi Arabian case was, if aircraft got more than 10 miles into Saudi Arabia, they'd have a go at it. We were slightly more lenient at that time and thinking that 25 miles was, you know, it's all a matter of, well, not seconds, but in a very short space of time, the difference between the two of something coming. But if it's a mistaken incursion, you don't want to make matters worse by shooting somebody down. So we were taking the more precautionary view about this.
And of course, it should be said, for people to be reminded, there were no fly zones at this stage. So the concept of controlling it.